Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 224. And it's a bit of a, it feels like a bit of a series this week and last week. Because last week's podcast was with Professor Green. Huge reaction online. I'd hyped it up quite a bit because we get into some big topics. And he's a great dude. So that was last week's episode. And this week's episode is with Example. And those two boys came up together. They were both on the beats. Professor Green comes up in a lot of the conversations today. It was interesting because I recorded Example first. So I put out Professor Green first because I wanted to make sure that when the Example one dropped right now, his mixtape was already out. It came out on Friday. You can go and check it out now. You don't have to wait. You can download it immediately. It's bangers and ballads. It's on iTunes. It's on Spotify. It's everywhere. So I switched them around, but it meant that in last week's episode with Pro Green, I didn't talk tons about his career in the early days. We talked a lot about what he's up to now, a lot of the stuff he's been through, a lot of mental health stuff. It was a really great open podcast because I knew that in the Example one this week, this episode's great because we kind of go all the way back. Because a lot of people don't realise how Example started out. I did a track with Example years ago. I've known the boy for 10 years or so now. So, yeah, I think you'll enjoy this one. Before we get into it, I should mention that we're brought to you as ever by Speech Development Records. If you head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you can get all sorts of good merch. When this one's live, we should have just launched our new web store. So go and have a look about. If you've been there before, it's worth having a look at a browse. I don't know if I should announce it because I'm not sure. I'm recording this on Friday, you see. On Monday, I'm planning to announce a new bit of signed merch. But I won't mention it now in case there's any hiccups and it doesn't come out. But head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and have a look if that new bit of signed our merch is there. As said, it was great to finally hook up with Example. It felt like perfect timing because, as you'll hear, he's just made the huge decision to set up his own label and take his career in his own hands. And yeah, it was, we both, I wanted you to get to know the Example that I know because you can get a lot of different perceptions. I think we talk about the fact he's come across differently at numerous different points in his career. I said to him, there's points that, you know, he's come across as a bit leery, a bit over the top, but, you know, it's great to discuss all that with him because we talk about his insecurities and why things can come across like that. The main point I made, I mean, I'm telling you the whole podcast now, but it's interesting. If you're that loud, leery dude, which Example is, again, and we talk about some of it being insecurities and things like that. But that's loved and adored if you're the underdog. If you're the unsigned artist, if you're on beats, if you're under Mike Skinner, that's adored. If you're then on top and you're having number one after number one, then there can be a backlash on that. But it's interesting, like, we get into all of that. If you enjoy this one, as I said, go back and check out Professor Green last week. Way back in the archive, I've got Mike Skinner. I've got Roots Maneuver. Chili Gonzalez a few weeks ago. Tons of good people. Kate Tempest is a previous guest and she's coming on again soon. So yeah, tons of good guests. Kate Nash, who we talk about in this, has been on recently. So yeah, check all of them out and I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end to give you some information. Next week's guest is one of the most exciting guests I've ever had. And I'm not going to tell you who it is because I've not recorded it yet. I'm recording it next week or as I record. So as you hear this, I will have hopefully recorded it yesterday, but I haven't yet. And when it's a big guest that I'm really excited about, I don't want to jinx it. So I'm going to out of nowhere drop a massive guest next week. And then, yeah, I've got some amazing ones lined up. Kate Tempest is coming back on, as I said. Bart Layton and Barry Keoghan were fantastic on in a few weeks. Drew Pearce, who wrote and directed Hotel Artemis, which I adored, is on in a few weeks. So yeah, loads of good stuff to come. Anyway, I'm going to go. This is episode 224 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Example. And we're rolling. How you doing, man? I'm here. I'm joined today by Example. How are you?
I'm very well. Sorry, I'm in the room. I'm just waiting for my pizza to come.
Yeah, yeah. We've kind of... You've ordered a Deliveroo and...
Franco Manca.
You know, we'll just... If we need to take a break, we'll take a break. If we need to just eat and plug through, I think that's fine as well. Everyone will be all right with that. It's podcasts.
I don't feel like you should eat on a podcast. I've done about 6 or 7 podcasts. This is the jewel in the crown for me now.
Excellent.
Tick that one off. And I've never eaten during it.
Because we do our drunk casts every now and then, and we literally will just be going for hours.
I'm surprised you didn't get me to do that.
We'll be eating, we'll be drinking, we'll be making all sorts of a mess. So it's always good fun. But has it been good? Like, it's been a minute, isn't it? Like, we've known each other for years, but I had Kate Nash on the other day, and it was a similar thing where I hadn't seen her in
similar
in 5-6 years, and I haven't. I've seen you in about that time. Oh, like we bumped into each other at festivals a bit.
Yeah, but I've known you since what, like 2007, six?
I'd say six, yeah.
We were just talking about off air.
Off air.
About the scene back then. And yeah, it did feel like a scene, and it wasn't like genre specific.
No.
But there were all these hot spots in London, you know, like Shoreditch before it became just like a branding corporate.
Gentrification
exercise. Shoreditch and Camden, there was a real scene.
Yeah.
And Archway.
Yeah.
And was it like the Holloway Road?
Yeah.
It could have been spoken word. It could have been an indie band. It could have been UK rap, grime, grindy.
Yeah.
And there were all these faces that you saw because what people miss out on now is you have Lovebox and you have Wireless.
Yeah.
And then Hyde Park. But other than that, where's the scene? There's no band scene. There's no pubs and clubs
completely.
For these acts to
through. It's completely found its way online, I guess. Need for that scene, maybe. I still think there is a need, but the feeling of a lack of need for that scene is because it's all gone online. And that was kind of starting at the time with MySpace and that. That was, I would say...
I think you were in my top eight, top 20, or whatever it was.
That's it. I would say there was... Shoreditch, Camden, Archway, and MySpace as the places that, because that's it, people did kind of interact and lock in on there. So it was a mad one at that time.
And there was collaborations, and it was like, and when you were putting together like your gig or your launch party or your tour, some of my Aussie missus influenced tour. You didn't really care about the genre. It was just like you brought your mates along.
Yeah, completely.
And people, I actually remember looking. I found a poster the other day for a gig I played at Hoxton Bar and Kitchen.
Yeah.
And the lineup was Metronomy.
Yeah.
Headlining. Foles.
Yeah.
Me. And Laura Dockrell.
It's mad, isn't it?
Dockers MC.
It's insane, yeah.
And
there was tons of that at the time.
And the crowd were just like having it and they didn't care.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a band from Essex called The Rifles.
Yep.
And I went on tour with them.
Yeah.
And I had some nights I had bread rolls thrown at me and coins, deservedly so. You know, I was on a sort of punk indie tour wearing t-shirts that said skinny jeans can fuck off.
Yeah.
And their manager was like, Example wants to come and support the Rifles? And I was like, it'd be a fucking laugh, wouldn't it? And some nights they loved it, some nights they didn't. One night we played Stoke and someone pulled a fire alarm. They pulled the fire alarm to get me off stage. They hated me so much.
And then
the promoter was like, look, there's only 5 minutes left. By the time they got everyone back in the venue, you don't want to go on 5 minutes, do you? I went, yeah, I'll go on and do one more song. And this was around 2006.
I love it.
And I just feel like all these acts coming through now don't get to experience, you know.
That mixture.
I mean, there's still some legendary venues around the UK.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, oh, they're grime, they have to go with grime acts. They're playing Afro Bashment, so they can only support other Afro Bashment.
There was a big mix, man. I remember in 1 week, I remember supporting Mark Ronson, and like the same week supporting Bizzle for his album launch, which considering, again, similarly, we had a song that was saying how shit the UK hip-hop scene was at that time.
Yeah.
So playing that to Bizzle's crowd was like a... You're close to getting fucked up. At his album launch as well, it was literally half and half. Half the crowd were loving it and half were just screw-face, arms crossed.
Yeah, because you had a lot of people who just obviously wanted the, you know, the Aggie element of it.
Yeah.
And then some people but that like, was it. Listen to what you're saying.
It was the mixture of
you're
everything.
You're just standing there quite still. Just
I'm like, standing there like... Because that was it at that time. Because me and Dan talked about it beforehand and I was like, we got to do Fixed because it's like, we play it to the little fucking indie kids, like supporting... Kate Nash the week before or playing with Saul Williams or whatever.
Yeah.
So we can't be two-faced about it. We've got to play it. If we mean it, we've got to mean it. So I was like, let's take the risk. But that was the beauty of the scene at that point.
You know, that's where you learnt the ropes and you sort of, you learnt what to do and what not to do. And I just think the kids now, and they are kids, you know, 18, 19.
Yeah.
And the difference is they can have one tune as a crossover hit on Spotify. And then their first ever gig is like Brixton Academy sold out.
That's, I mean, that's
and I quite like the fact by the time I got to Brixton Academy, I'd already done 600 shows and some of them were playing to four people.
And that's a great point there because the easiest gigs are not necessarily the gigs that make you good are when you're playing to your audience.
Yeah, yeah.
The hard gigs are when you're having to win an audience over. Yeah, yeah. And there will be kids these days and fair
I'm not knocking them, it's not their fault.
I've been to,
I'm not going to mention names, but I've been to see some of these, you know, this new generation of grime and rap acts and so on. And they've got no stagecraft.
Yeah.
And I almost feel for them. And the crowd.
Because they've come straight into as soon as you walk on stage.
And you've got 4,000 to 5,000 people.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you've never been booed.
Yeah,
you've never had stuff thrown at you. You've never had a fire alarm. You've never done 100 gigs supporting somewhere else to performing to other people's fans.
Yeah.
You don't know what to do if the mic breaks. You don't know what to do if you know there's a fight in the crowd. There's all these things you see touring over the years.
Completely,
you know, a pint's thrown at you, and
it was the
you slip over on stage. And how do you style it out? And what do you say between songs is another thing. You know.
The surprising benefit I had of coming up in the spoken word scene was if there was any sound issues, it made the show better because I could jump in the crowd and do a spoken word piece screaming and people would be going nuts. It's like, whereas a lot of kids these days will be like, oh, we're just going to we'll have to wait until it's fixed and that kind of thing. But you'd kind of, when I found, or when that scene was happening, you'd kind of come up a year, like only a year or so before that, I felt, on kind of, I remember
the first thing that got played
you being
was,
about in the battle rap scenes and things like that and all that. So how was that? Like, how did you find yourself? How did Elliot from Fulham go, right, I'm going to start off as a rapper and start a rapping and MCing?
I didn't even know, to be honest, what I wanted to do. I only rapped in school to sort of, like, as protection. Because, everything was... I went to school not far from where we are now. We're in South London now, in Wandsworth. And it was like, you know... It's a typical London comprehensive. It was a mix of everyone, you know, from estates. You know, there'd be some really rich kids who lived in a mansion in Roehampton to kids who come from, like, gutter estates in Battersea and Clapham and Brixton. It was a real nice mix. But the dominant music culture was black music, you know, and hip-hop, R&B. There wasn't really much of a UK scene then. So everyone was trying to emulate that. I was always good with words and rhyming. And I found it really easy to, like, remember a whole Wu-Tang Clan song.
And then
I realised, because I was shit at football, I was shit at basketball, shit at rugby.
That's what you've got.
It was like, when you're 11, 12 years old, and, you know, the other cool kids are considerably bigger, more well-developed than you, they're already starting off with girls, and I was, like, years late to that. So rapping was my only thing.
Yeah.
And originally it was other people's lyrics.
Yeah.
But I never saw it as a career, because we didn't have... anyone to look up to them. We didn't have a Mike Skinner. We didn't have a Dizzy Rascal. So it was like rapping in a British accent wasn't even a thing. And then it was like the whole rule book was rewritten, I think, with the streets for me.
Yeah, I agree.
And then I came back from a year in Australia. And I wasn't doing like a gap year. I was just sort of working. I was working, making props on film sets and stuff.
Dope.
And I met this girl. And her hooked up with her, and her brother was actually in a big band in Oz.
Yeah.
He let me use his recording studio. I came back to the UK in 2004 with a load of demos.
Amazing.
Got a job back in TV, I was in bits of editing, promos, voiceovers, you know, working in tape libraries. And then just started, I put a song out on vinyl, I pressed 1,000 copies and we sold 10. The next single, So Many Roads, which sampled the Carpenters, yeah. the original 7-inch release, I thought, right, I'm going to only press 500 vinyls of this.
Yeah.
We sold them out. We had to do like repressings.
Amazing.
And then someone handed a record to Zane Lowe, I Don't Want To, which was a song I sampled, Muddy Waters.
Right.
I don't want to be true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
We chopped it up. So instead of saying, I just want to make love to you, it was, I don't want to make love to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was sort of like my calling card, this sort of cheeky lad rap talking about awkward relationships.
Yeah, completely.
Yes, Zane Lowe played it. Pete Tong played it back when Pete Tong used to actually play hit, like two or three hip hop tracks on every Friday.
And the difference that those guys could make at that point was
huge. I was just working in TV thinking, I want to be a director, I want to be a screenwriter, I want to be an actor.
Yeah.
And had no idea about really performing. I'd done garage raves and I'd done like a few rap battles.
Yeah.
But I was like, I had no idea what I was doing. I just made it up as I went along.
Yeah.
And then like this guy approached me and he was like, do you want me to be a radio plug? I was like, what, radio plug? He was like, mate, you've just been played by Pete Tong and Zane Lowe 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
And then I had all these deals all of a sudden. It's like, I needed a manager and all this shit. And my manager, actually, he's an old Essex lad. He's about 65 now.
Yeah.
He signed the publishing for The Streets and Plan B.
Yeah, yeah,
Metronomy, Frank Turner.
Yeah.
And he's only ever managed me and been my publisher. And I didn't realize at the time how important he was and instrumental he was, but he kind of just let me be me.
Yeah.
And when I came and first met him, he was like, I'd never signed you for your rapping. And I hadn't even heard you sing by then. He was like, there's just this kid there who spoke a bit street, but he was from Fulham and like had long mop hair back then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like, I just thought you was a star. I just didn't know what type of music you should be doing. I just thought this kid needs to be on stage.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, you know, start the journey, but it kind of explains where I'm at now. It's like, it's not about the rapping, it's not about the singing, it's just like, it's just being me, you know what I mean, having fun with music.
And that's the key, the exciting thing, and we'll get onto it, is that the music that you're making now and you're about to start putting out isn't stuff that you could have made back then. It isn't stuff that you could have made during your ministry era and all that kind of thing. And it's like it's the combination of all of it to get there. So how was it kind of coming up in the scene and or suddenly out of nowhere having airplay and with that expectation? Like, how was that for you? Did that make you start going, what am I meant to be aiming for?
Yeah, well, I just thought, well, there's a couple of gig offers were coming in, you know, so it was like, oh, you can get paid 300 quid to go and like perform four or five songs at a pub. And I was like, what?
Sweet.
That's a ridiculous amount of money.
Yeah, yeah,
so my mum and dad had moved to Australia.
Right.
My dad decided he'd been working every day of his life and he was like, I don't want to work anymore. He'd never be able to retire in the UK, but sold his house at the right time, moved out, and he moved to Australia. It was like $3 to the pound.
Yeah.
So he's out there and I'm thinking about going to join them in Australia again.
Yeah.
And I end up staying in the UK and I'm living with my step granddad in this really old fashioned house. So I sort of had some hunger and drive there. I needed, you know, because everyone needs something to make you.
To push them on.
Yeah, definitely. And it was partly trying to prove to my parents that I could make music work for me.
Yeah.
And they're on the other side of the world. My sister had moved to Sydney. They were living like on the Gold Coast. So I was like by myself, like for the first time in my life. And even though I had a roof over my head, you know, I was like, what am I going to do? You know, fuck, I've got to set up a bank account and, you know, I've got to pay house insurance. How'd you do that? It was like becoming independent. And like, and even I was 22, I'd been working since I was a kid, you know, like since I had a job when I was 15. But it was like, fuck, I've actually got to start living now. I've got to be a grown up.
Honestly,
if my parents had stayed in the country, I wouldn't even be here talking to you because I don't think I'd still be living at home. But you sort of expect things.
You don't have that kind of.
So then music was like, I was more determined to make music work because my dad was like, my mum and dad aren't really creative people.
Yeah.
They love their arts, but they're not singers. They're not like creative like that. And they were just like, my dad was like, you're so good at maths. You know, you took your GCSEs early.
Yeah.
Got A's and A stars. Like, go and work in the bank. You know, I'd done some work experience and been offered a job in a bank, like a Chase Manhattan JP Morgan. I got offered a job when I was 16.
It's a proper job, right?
And I was like, fuck that. I've got to make music work. And I didn't have a fucking clue what to do. I didn't know how to do. I knew a lot about TV and filmmaking, so the music videos was cool. But I was like, pressing vinyls and what's a plugger? And, you know, marketing and all this sort of shit.
Yeah.
And how'd you get in a magazine? How'd you get someone to review you in a magazine? So I was literally just going in and out of record shops, meeting people, Deal Real Records, College Street, and just, who is this? Can you introduce me to someone like that? I was driving around the country in my mum's old Vauxhall Corsa dropping off vinyls.
Yeah.
I love that.
Not knowing how to do it, but just going out and finding out.
Now you can just stick your song on SoundCloud or Spotify. I know there's other parts of the process. You know, you've got to have a brand and your social media, Instagram, you've got to have a profile.
Yeah.
But back then, and we were in a period like 2005, 6, 7, so much changed, you know, because you got obviously MySpace revolution, YouTube.
And all of
a sudden it's like, okay, it went so quickly from vinyls to, oh, no, we don't need vinyls anymore, to, no, we don't need CDs anymore, to, we need MP3s.
Yeah.
And like, it's almost like what happened over 40, 50 years in the music industry to get from, like, vinyls to cassettes to CDs.
Yeah.
That happened in, what, like, 30, 40 years. And then we had this something that happened in, like, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
All this revolution. It's like, and it's just as you get into MySpace and you've got all these fans on MySpace, it's like, no, MySpace is dead now. Yeah. Fuck, what's this thing? Now you need to get it on SoundCloud. Oh no, that's dead. And it's like iTunes. Oh no, that's dead now. It's Spotify.
And MySpace is at the forefront of that, because that's where a lot of people who hadn't been able to press CDs or press vinyl, that's the only place their music could be available.
Yeah. I mean,
it was like it was on there. It was on their little MySpace player. You can go.
JME revolutionised it, didn't he? Do you remember he found out JME, if anyone doesn't know, the Grime MC.
Yeah.
But he's an amazing entrepreneur. But he sort of hacked all the MySpace codes.
Right.
You know, in terms of like his whole page, it turned it into his website, and he had more songs than everyone else. He had all his own little like graphics and it's incredible. And I remember he was like the benchmark at that time. He really used that to its max. And now people are doing the same thing with Instagram. It's like getting likes, you know, rather than actual plays or people engaging with your songs. It's just like all for the likes and the comments I just still can't keep up with it.
It's fascinating how
and that's why
changed.
I just have to be me and do me and just do what comes naturally. So I never got on Snapchat because I thought I don't want to snap all day long about my life.
Yeah.
And there was pressure at the time to, you know, you've got to get on this new platform and do this. But yeah, so anyway, long story short, 2007, signed to Mike Skinner's label.
Yeah. And so how was that? Because Mike, as said, was the benchmark at that point, and it revolutionised things and made it. They changed everything. He had content. He also had bangers. Yeah, yeah. He had everything in there. So,
and he was just
how
himself.
Was that to sign?
Well, I had three offers. I had two major labels, and I had Mike Skinner, The Beats, which was part of Warner, and they just put out the Mitchell Brothers album, and they just signed Professor Green as well.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just adored Mike, and I just thought, even if I could kind of sense they didn't really know what they were doing at the label, but I quite like that.
I could relate to that. Yeah.
They ran it out of a shed in... I still can't believe the pizza's not here, man.
Unbelievable.
Oh, your order's out for delivery, thank God. If anyone's worried about my food. And I just thought, they're running out of a shed in Kew.
Yeah.
And it was an old Jeffrey Kemp insurance. It was like,
amazing.
They referenced it on a few old Streets mixtapes. And it was literally a shed, and there was a toilet. And it had on the door, no shitting, just spitting.
I love it.
With a microphone in there. And you could have a piss, but literally you had to go around to the cafe around the corner if you needed to take a shit. It was that kind of vibe.
It
was amazing because I'd get the train down once or twice a week, and you never knew who would be there. So some days, like Skinner was doing a remix of one of his Street songs, and you'd have like Ghetto, Skepta, Kano, Jeremy, Tinchy Strider, all these people would be down there and all their crew. And it was like proper moody back then. It's not like Grime MCs now smile. They're allowed to like... you know, say sweet things and buy their mums
at that point
stuff.
It was rough, and that was dope as well, because
that was reflecting their life, and it was all very there was never no fun and games and laughter.
I think Mike should get more credit for putting a lot of that over as well,
because
those early Streets remixes, which he was barely on at all, it was the first time I heard a lot of the grime artists, and it was like, oh wow, and it was aggressive and angry. It wasn't the friendly Mike Skinner. This is a street song. It was like, Ghetto in particular, just fucking.
And what's amazing now is that like someone like Stormzy still has that aggression
in
the songs, but then you can go on breakfast television and be the sweetest guy in everyone's mind. I love that Stormzy guy. And I don't think people know how to do that then.
It's such a.
And it's sort of like, so anyway, getting off topic.
Yeah.
So you'd be going down to the studio and it'd be like, I'd be arriving to lay down a third verse on something, and Pro Green would be in there finishing off something for his new mixtape. I went down there once and Pete Doherty was in there recording his Pranging Out remix, the street song Pranging Out. Yeah. And he was just sat there, you know, there's a smell of burning rubber or plastic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this isn't a newsflash, he's a bit of a drug addict.
Yeah.
And it was the first time it was like, fuck, it's that guy from the newspapers is in the studio. And then Skinner will come down occasionally. And it was just an amazing era of like, for about a year, this tiny little space where there was like stacks of Pro Green's mixtapes. There was Mitchell Brothers t-shirts. Yeah. There was like posters. There was like some gold discs which had been smashed that some had forgotten about. There was one little sofa. Sometimes the engineer would be asleep in there overnight. On the floor, there were scraps of weed and like half a pill and like little dusts of cocaine. And there's fucking, you know, a kettle over there, which is like melted because it was caught on fire. And someone was all in the space of where we're sat, similar to where we're sat now, like 2 meters by 4 meters.
Yeah.
And I just remember, and at the time I just thought, this is fucking exciting. This is the music industry, isn't it? Like, I thought maybe this is how they ran. It reminded me of like Factory Records or something like that. You know what I mean?
24-hour party people. But because again, it felt like real people could be making real music without having to plug into a big machine. It was part of Warner.
It was a Mac
again, it was
and a mic. And that was
doing it. Yeah.
And a little desk, like the desk in the studio was like, you know, what you do your exams on when you're 16. And that, I mean, I was chatting to, I saw Stephen Pro Green the other week. Yeah. I still see him like quite often. We're good mates.
He's coming on the podcast soon as well. I've got him on.
Oh, he's incredible. That guy, his brain's amazing. And we were just reminiscing about this stuff. And at the time, we didn't realize how important this stuff was to shaping us. Because once you've been and done that, you can do anything. Which is why I've never had a studio. And then I set up this studio where we are now about 2 years ago. And I wanted something that reflected that. I wanted something really humble. I don't want any gold platinum plaques on the wall. I don't want any pictures. I don't care if it smells a bit damp.
Yeah.
Because just I want to recreate that desperation.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, over the last year, I've had so many people through it, loads of MCs and rappers. And sometimes it's just to, you know, excite me about my job. And they all say the space, you know, is amazing. Then you go to the big plush ones where there's a studio assistant and the engineer's got an assistant. Yeah. And there's no vibe. I can't write in rooms like that.
I completely agree. And so that was a great time because it was really, as you said, it was allowing you to make your music. Is it here? Is it here? Go. Go get it. I'll pause.
Sorry.
It's all good. In fact, I'm not even going to pause. I'm going to talk to you around the room. We've got kind of fairy lights up at the moment. It's a nice chilled vibe. There's a mic stand in the corner. Oh, with a good kind of shield, dead end shield around it. So isn't it? You don't even have to have a mic booth, really. We've got the desk, which is a nice little desk with a Mac on there, some good speakers, got some keys, got a little guitar in the corner. I'll pause now and let Buddy edit this part out.
Nice. Is that what the doctor ordered? Not only have I made you drive over the whole fucking length of London, I've made you wait until I get pizza.
It's fine. I celebrate a pizza moment. That's some good pizza right there.
Are we recording?
Franco Manca only. I've left it rolling. Yeah, why not? Let's make it real.
If I get too slurpy on the.
Yeah. So I'll soundtrack it now. He's example. He's pouring a nice glass of red wine into a plastic cup, as should be.
I'm just going to take one bite
and tearing off a slice. No, you go in, son. You go in and enjoy.
Oh my god!
And Franco Manca, right? It's the best in town.
Sourdough pizza, mate. Neapolitan style. The oven has to be, I think, 500 degrees.
Yeah. I've got a pizza oven in my back garden. And the most I've been able to get it up to is about 400 degrees.
Is that a wood-fired one?
Yeah, a wood-fired one. I sling all the wood in the back. I did it recently and I realised the problem I'd had was you need to fire it up for 3 to 4 hours. It's no kind of just sling some logs in there. Oh, it's started to get hot because this is fascinating information. But at that point, you're getting the heat off the flames rather than heating up the bricks that built this whole thing and the plaster and everything. And that's where you want. Yeah.
I do as well. I mean, I haven't got a garden, so I live in an apartment.
Yeah.
You know, but my oven, yeah. My Gaggenau.
Yeah.
I'm not sponsored by them or anything.
Yeah, it's good.
it goes up to 350.
It's dope.
Which is amazing for because the pizzas need to just be quick in and out, don't they?
Yeah. That's completely. It should be a few minutes. And the dough, again, like this, it's dope that Franco Manca and people like that have got big because it's meant to be about the dough. In the West, we kind of made pizza about the toppings.
Mm.
It's meant to be about the dough. You're meant to be able to have minimal toppings and just some well-made dough rather than... But in this country, it's 100%. It's the toppings you've got on it.
Well, there's a time it's all and a this. Place for Domino's.
Completely.
You know, you come back from the pub, I think... If someone goes, "Should we get Franco Manca or Domino's?" Domino's is that, but yeah, in a way, it's you. Not really pizza. It's like, yeah. It's its own thing, isn't it?
It completely is. I'll be excited. I could have had Domino's three nights in a row, and I'll be in London. I'll be like, "Oh, it'd be good to have some pizza," because I've not been thinking I've had pizza three nights in a row. I'm thinking, "Oh, it'd be good to go Franco Manca or one of the other great
the same
ones."
Thing, isn't it? It just yeah. serves a purpose. It's not even. I don't even feel like I'm eating.
Yeah. Yeah,
Domino's, you know what I mean. It's just a means to an end.
And Pizza Hut and Papa John's as well. They're all in that same basket of their. Or again, it's the Americanized pizza, isn't it?
Mm.
Papa John can pretend to be as Italian as he wants. He's serving American pizza. He ain't anyone's Papa.
John, Papa. AKA Elton John.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. If you get Papa John spots,
yeah,
and you draw a set of glasses on Papa John,
amazing.
It turns into Elton John.
I love it. That's perfect.
It's like one of those, you know, like someone's like, you get out a £5 note and someone folds it and goes, "Did you know this?" And they show you and you go, "Fucking hell.
I can't wait."
Let's get Papa John's box and draw little specks on it.
Yeah.
It turns into Elton John.
I'm doing it. I'm doing it next time I get one.
Do you want a red wine, by the way?
No, I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm on the water.
Do you drink?
I do drink. I drink a handful of times a year. I'm honestly, I'm not a big, just a social a drinker anymore. I used to be and I just went off it. So I drink on the drunk cast, I drink at my club night, but they're kind of the only places I generally fancy a drink. Like, it's weird. It's like anything, I guess. Anything you get out of the habit of, you stop craving. So there's numerous times, particularly in the heat we've had recently, that a few years back, I'd be craving a cider or a beer or whatever. Just doesn't happen.
I find that in London,
yeah,
because I live between Australia and here, I do like, my wife's Australian. And we've got two little boys and we do like 4 months in Oz and the rest of the time over here. And pretty much we'll probably be based there
just
to raise the kids.
Yeah.
And
because that was it when we've been lining this podcast up for ages and it's always like,
well, I'm
sure you live in Australia. So I was like, it depends when you're over or when. And this was, again, it's perfect timing as we'll get into all of it. But yeah. So you split between the two.
Yeah, split between the two. And when I'm in Oz, the main reason I loved being there and I can't wait to move there is because I'm so much healthier.
Yeah.
Like, just training every day. We've got both sets of our parents around to help out with the kids.
Yeah.
And we, you know, might have a glass of red wine with dinner.
Yeah.
But there's nothing to tempt you.
Yeah.
Like, especially in Brisbane. It's like such a sleepy place. I mean, it's an amazing functional city. But in terms of like that creative buzz that I get in London, London's amazing for writing
all those
songs.
Distractions as well.
But
yeah.
For my health and longevity.
Well, you went from...
I want Australia because I just become an addict when I'm back over here.
You went from that skinny dance rap kid to like proper, you beefed up, you got in fantastic shape. And it's like, it's a lifestyle change, isn't it? It's because if you go somewhere that encourages that kind of lifestyle change, like I'm far better at being healthy, exercising constantly when I'm at home.
Because
I can just control what food I've got in, all that kind of thing. Whereas if I'm on the road or I'm in London a lot, it's like, oh, I'm just going to grab a burger here or do this or do that, or I'm not going to have time to exercise.
London's just one of those places that just feeds whatever your addiction is. And I'm talking whether it's smoking or coffee or burgers, fast food, drugs, whatever. It's like London, just a place like London feeds that because it's 100%. So manic. All the time. And I'm lucky, I live right on the river and I've got the top floor and I get to look over London. But because I'm on the river, I feel free of that.
Yeah.
So I feel relaxed, almost like I live in the countryside because I'm up away from everything. I'm still close enough by it. But
there are those spots in London, aren't there? That can give you that. It feels like it's not
Yeah, which is what I need, because it was either move out of London or, you know, stay put, but find the right view where I feel free and escape. But as soon as I step onto the street level, it's just the stress. And you really notice it when I've been in Brisbane.
Yeah.
You know, we can drive from our place to the centre of town in like 10 minutes. There's no traffic. Everyone's happy all the time. The weather's amazing. Your strangers are smiling and chatting to you. You can always find a parking space.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a seat on the bus. And it's just like, even though there's not the exciting creatives, there's not the melting pot. So London, you know, I wouldn't be who I was without London. You know, the multiculturalism and the genre mashup, which is my music and, I suppose, my life. You know, I miss that in Oz.
Yeah,
but I can see how happy my kids are, and I can see how healthy I am. I get so much sleep.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because that's a heavenly, idyllic, a way to live. But it's not going to make that many great albums.
No,
or that many great. Great bits, like it's why we've
well, like, this I try is, and write this songs sounds in like Australia, a bias,
but I can't think of tons of huge Australian acts or Australian acts I'm into. And there have been some, but it's not like you're awash with it, because it is. It's there's so much to just relax and enjoy, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. And it is. I do 2-3 months over there, and I'm like, oh my god, this is the life. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you go on social media, which I shouldn't do, and then you see like gig footage of Fabric and your favourite drum and bass DJ.
And
there's a mosh pit.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck, I need to get back to London. So, and then like I do 6 months in London and I'm completely worn out and I haven't been training as much as I like.
Yeah.
And especially with two kids, you're getting 5 hours sleep some nights. Yeah, right. Man. You're like, I want to be back in Australia where we've got free babysitters. And then you crave that and I go over there. And that just basically sums me up, is it's just sort of like, you know, I'm all or nothing.
It's great to have the combination of the two, right?
Yeah,
to be able to switch between them and dart back and forth.
Exactly.
So let's rewind. I just want to finish off a little bit of the Skinner era, because it did feel as if that was a point where the first introduction a lot of people had to Example was allowing you to get a full character across. And when he was doing the Beat Stevie stuff and stuff like that
It was just us backstage. I mean, there's a video of me backstage at Reading.
Yeah.
Where, because I still have a big fear of crowds, not performing to them, but being in them.
Yeah.
And I got into like Class A's like really quite late. I was like 24.
Yeah.
And so when I was at school, everyone else was doing drugs, and I was just like, I was so anti it, didn't get it. And then how do you get by in the music industry without either being an alcoholic or smoking loads of weed or doing loads of gear or something? But I think when I signed for the Beats, in Mike and Professor Green as well, I found like a sort of kindred spirit and this sort of like freedom to not only, I didn't actually know who I was as Example or Elliot. And then it was this freedom to explore, and I sort of went a bit crazy. And I think that's what was great about Beats TV, is it just sort of caught, it captured me and Stephen, me and Pro, in a really quite, we were like almost like quite fragile and young and innocent and impressionable.
Yeah.
And didn't really care about money and fame, and didn't really care about having a hit. We just couldn't believe someone like Mike wanted to take us on the road.
And
like sort of give us his stamp of approval, and obviously attention from the opposite sex, and, you know, free booze and free gig tickets and meeting loads of, you know, celebs. So it was just like this big whirlwind. So because we're just caught up in that, you went to the studio and you weren't overthinking what you were doing. You were like, this rhymes with this, and I want to, you know, tell this story. And that beat's quite banging. And you just end up with these, you know, Stephen's first album, or his mixtape, Lectures Number One, and my first album, What We Made. And I did a mixtape of covers as well, remixes, called We Didn't Invent the Remix. So I had like my Britney Spears Toxic cover and Lily Allen's Vile. A cover of Smile, which Chris Moyles played on The Breakfast Show, like, you know, 3 weeks in a row. It was just sort of like the definition of like free spirited and like making it up as you're going along.
Yeah.
And then I still carried that through. So the Beats was dropped by Warner in 2008, just after my album came out.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about going back working to TV again, because I was like, what were you thinking? Thinking you could be a rapper, you know, be a
Did you do a bit of comedy at that point?
So I was doing stand up.
That's what I remember you doing, a bit of stand up around there.
I did 10 gigs. here and there. I'd play the biggest one was like for a TV show.
Did you go with Jupiter's at some point? I'm sure. Yeah, Jupiter's so there was
the Culture Show. Do you remember the Culture Show?
Yeah.
Culture Show was amazing. Great and show. The producer of that said, "Wouldn't it be great if you a rapper tried stand up? A bit like that Faking It show."
Yeah.
And I was like, it was one of the things that really, really scared me. But whenever I get scared by something, it makes me want to do it more.
Yeah, of course.
And Richard Herring was my mentor.
Yeah.
And then I ended up on this lineup, on this billing, and with Harry Hill, Phil Jupitus, Richard Herring, and me. And he was like, "Look, just go up and do 2 or 3 minutes."
Yeah.
He says, "If you can do 2 or 3 minutes, it'd be amazing if you get a few laughs." And I ended up doing like 8 or 9 minutes, which is an eternity in stand-up. Yeah, there's no backing 100%, 100%, track. You know, there's no band behind you.
No, completely.
And it's on YouTube, actually. I think it's an example does stand-up. Yeah. And it was 500 people at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith. And
that's madness.
And, you know, I headlined the other stage at Glastonbury and we had about 40,000 people and we were up against the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And if I think about what was the most thrilling experience I've ever had on stage, you know, I sold out Earls Court.
Yeah.
Just before they knocked it down, 22,000 tickets.
Yeah.
People don't believe me, right? But you'll know this. I've been on stage and especially with the spoken word thing.
Yeah.
The buzz you get from just holding a room with just your voice.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Whether it's giggles or, you know, clapping or laughter or they're dancing or they're just listening, just having that.
I completely agree. The clearest memories for me are those spoke, like I did.
If I could be a stand-up or be example, I'd be a stand-up. Yeah. It's the best buzz in the world.
The same year I headlined spoken word stage at Latitude and it was about 1,000 people and the buzz of just holding those, at a festival as well, holding them in silence. It was amazing. The year before, my favourite non-spoken word gig with Dan Lesak at Bestival on the main stage, and we had 20 to 30,000. Amazing, but... Or doing... easier example, doing a Wembley supporting a Frank Turner, and he had his whole crowd there. I didn't enjoy the gig that much because I didn't feel as attached or intimate. It felt
going through the motions.
It was an amazing... I'm still glad it happened. I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity. If I think of what was the most amazing experience, it was that spoken word gig just there with just me and a mic and doing an hour at a festival me and a mic going, shit, they're on board.
Of all the... I've tried a bit of acting because it's one of those... Like, I'm the biggest cinephile ever. I just grown up loving films. I studied film at university.
Yeah.
I wrote my dissertation on the Terminator movies. It was called From Killing Machine to Parental Cyborg.
Amazing.
The changes in masculinity between 80s and 90s action heroes. And I got like a first for like
that. Yeah,
I was obsessed with films. I only went to university because I've heard there was a film course.
Yeah.
University weren't for me. It was like, Royal Holloway Uni, so I was 70% female, tick. I've got a gym, tick. You can stay on campus and there's like free bars nearby, tick. And you can just watch films and discuss films in a room with people use their editing suite and their camera facility. So, it's just using that as a basis. And then having tried bits of acting and worked in TV and done music, and the biggest buzz, I reckon, is stand up.
Yeah.
I can imagine like stepping out, you know, running 100-meter race at the Olympics or FA Cup final.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, apart from running in a straight line, I'm shit at sports.
Yeah.
So, and swimming in a straight line.
Yeah.
So stand up is the one thing where I still think there'd be room for it. I don't know when and how. If I was bankrupt and no one wanted to hear example music ever again.
Yeah,
stand-up would be the first thing I'd go to.
You see, the tough thing there is the similar problem that we were talking about earlier of a lot of these kids who have an instant hit online and instantly have got a crowd. To get good at stand-up, you have to play to people who don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing a stand-up gig and your fans are there, they're predisposed to come and enjoy it. You won't know if you're good for a long while. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You'll be getting laughs because they like... Oh, look, it's example.
Well, you don't have to. Like, they've got the most... the guys I've
like, you must have had that at gigs, like just talking in between and making jokes and people getting into it. It's like, you're not a stand-up at that stage, but it's your crowd, so they're easy to win over.
I went and saw Adele at Wembley, and she chats for like sometimes 4 or 5 minutes between every song.
Yeah.
And I was sat there watching it, and Alan Carr's next to me, and he's like, fucking it, she's funnier than me, you know, like and she is, and you almost she breaks out into one of her, you know, global monster hits, and you're like, can't wait for the song to finish so you can hear some her more chat of your again. Chat.
Yeah, I love it.
And she almost becomes like a caricature of herself because she's so smart.
Yeah.
You know, like she sees the reaction she gets when she's on like a talk show, a Graham Norton or a Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
And it's just like, so not only have I got the best voice in the world and got some of the biggest songs ever written, I'm actually just like this hilarious stand-up.
Yeah.
And she really milks that.
I wish
I could do that on my show, but it's almost like, my gigs are raves, you know what I mean? I want people jumping from the start of the set to the end of the set. It's not like we build up to a crescendo. It's just like mosh pit from the start.
So let's talk about the transition into that. Because you were known for kind of...
Lad rap.
Tongue-in-cheek, lad rap, quite comedy. And it's an interesting one.
And occasionally there was some serious dark stuff. Like, I mean, there's like What We Made, which was about, global Armageddon. Destruction, nuclear. I shot the music video in Chernobyl for that one.
Fucking A,
And then there was a couple of other songs like No Sleep for the Wicked, where I was sort of, it was my first sort of delving into battling your psyche and, you know.
Yeah, but it was storytelling.
It was mainly humour.
Intricate lyrics. It was all that, like it was, or not intricate, but packed lyrics.
Yeah, so it was mainly humour. So then I've left, the Beats sort of disbanded, Mike Skinner's label. Yeah. Warner dropped them. From what I understand, it was like they just spent 300-400 grand on like the Mitchell Brothers second album and it hadn't worked. They were amazing actually. I don't know.
They
had a song. Check this, right? So it's actually such a shame because they were such lovely fellas and they weren't like the best rappers, but as a package, they were just so much character. They had a song called Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And it was their make or break hit. And basically the label, the Beats, was everything was resting on this song being a hit.
Right.
And I remember them saying to us, like, to me and Pro Green, and they were starting to develop other acts at the time. They were like, look, if this Mitchell Brothers album and this single don't go well, Warner are going to cut all funds and then the Beats won't exist anymore. Yeah. And I was just like, I didn't really care that I didn't have a record deal. I was like, I want to be able to come to the shed and queue every week. And, one, you know, maybe Pete Doherty's in there. I don't know who's going to be there tomorrow. Damon Albarn's in there with a fucking dog. On mushrooms, I don't know. So I didn't want this sort of dream to end.
Yeah,
it's almost like being that honeymoon period's over.
Completely.
But all good things must come to an end. And they had this song produced by Calvin Harris. So Calvin Harris, his first album had come out, so he'd had Acceptable in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't have his first big hit until I'm Not Alone or You're Not Alone.
Yeah.
If I see a light flashing, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
That was his first number one.
Yeah.
So Calvin Harris had produced a song for the Mitchell Brothers called Michael Jackson. And the chorus went, I wish I could move like Michael Jackson. Then around. It was like very streetsy.
Yeah, yeah,
it was also very gimmicky as well.
Yeah.
So Calvin's produced it. And then Robbie Williams sang the chorus. So it was going to be the Mitchell Brothers featuring Robbie Williams produced by Calvin Harris. And for whatever reason, Robbie ended up coming off it.
Right.
The single flopped. And within like a week... the label was like over.
That's mad.
And I was just like, well, I want to see Professor Green every week and do loads of MDMA and drink Stella.
This is where I go.
Yeah, I just want to go to Camden and, you know, come out of a pub and like that's life for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's no, I need to be on TV, I need to be rich, I need to be famous, I need to have hits. It was just like, this is my life.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how long it was going to last.
I think what's key at that point though is you, as you'd said earlier, you still hadn't necessarily found who you wanted to be or what you wanted to do musically. You were just kind of open
songs,
to what you wanted to do.
But I didn't know how to write a hit.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't trying to write hits. You know, Skinner was A&R in me and Steven. I still keep all the emails that Skinner wrote to me. Some of them are like 1,000 words.
Yeah.
And the stuff, there's a lot of stuff he did really wrong and got wrong. And I think he was a bit too controlling and wanted me and Steven to be exactly certain things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Mike's an obsessive and he's like, his knowledge of, especially of hip hop, is incredible. You know, he was the stuff that he would tell me about when the Beastie Boys first came out, they did this. And when so-and-so came out and you need to have something to rebel against, the kids have got to love you. And it was like, oh shit. And I took a lot of it on board, but there was some other advice as well, which was completely wrong.
Yeah.
But that's just A&R, I suppose.
Yeah, sure.
Imagine having the streets as A&R.
Yeah.
That's why I've still kept all these emails in a folder on my Yahoo email.
I love that.
And then, so literally it all just like imploded. Their last Beats TV episode, Beats TV, but they called it Beat Stevie.
Yeah.
Genius. That Miami Vice sort of logo. Yeah, do you remember?
Yeah.
And the last episode was they had a coffin, and
right.
It was like the Beats funeral.
And right.
They
just
sort of
burnt
this coffin. They did. It's on YouTube. They did a load of gear off the top of this
amazing
coffin. They set fire to it. And it was, you know, like proper enemy fodder.
Yeah.
You know, enemy all down there taking pictures. Mike Skinner's Beats is banned. But I remember at the time, as it ended, I was like, fuck, this whole thing's sort of been about Mike. Mm. Not whether he was, you know, doing it as like a vanity project label. I don't know what his intentions were. I think he genuinely wanted to develop apps.
Yeah, completely.
And he wanted to have his own label. And he wanted to, in order to be successful. And I do think he really cared about us. But what I realised after that was, like, Professor Green's one of the best rappers in the country.
Yeah.
Freestyling and written, whatever. He's just like, I'm never going to be as good as that. And then he's doing his own thing, and you can see why Mike liked that. And I didn't really know what Mike saw in me, but he obviously saw something. And, you know, out of three acts, two of them have gone into, you know, smash it, and then the Mitchell brothers, sadly, were no more. But if you look back at that period, well, when I look back at that period, I'm like, no one was there asking me how I felt.
Yeah.
Afterwards. And every time I got interviewed around then, it was like, so tell us about Mike. And at the time I didn't, but no one ever said, what's your new single about? Who is Example? Where did you grow up? What music did you listen to? It was always so tell us some funny stories about Mike on tour.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't you? Because he was the biggest act in the country
Completely.
At the time. So as the label ended, I was like, no one actually gives a shit about me.
It's
like,
mad,
even though I had fans.
It's that mad snake eating its own tail. Because again, that's what brought the attention in
initially,
because it was
other,
Mike's label and Mike was so big. But equally,
it's the most credible start.
Even
you can
though
have.
He will have had the best intentions, it's still going to be all under his shadow.
Yeah.
So how was it to step out from under that?
Well, then I just thought, then I lost complete faith in everything. And I was like, right, I'm going to move to Australia. And my mum and dad were like, to be fair, they were like, son, look, you've given it a good go. You know, you've done, I've probably done 300 gigs at this point.
Yeah.
I supported Just Jack,
Kate
Wear, Kate Fly, The Rifles. And I was just like, I need to pack this all in and move to Australia and pursue my love of films. And then, like, I was applying to get into Australia. I thought it would be straightforward. It's one of the hardest countries in the world to get a visa.
Right.
And it was like, yeah, your first class degree from University of London means fuck all. You've got to go back to university in Australia for 2 years if you want to become a resident.
Damn. Yeah.
So I was like, well, fuck that. So I went back to work in TV. And then I got a call from Ministry of Sound.
Yeah.
Dave Dollymore, legend, who's now head of RCA.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought me in for a meeting, and he was just like, I've listened to your album, I've listened to your mixtape. And he goes, what I really like on the mixtape is your cover of Britney Spears' Toxic.
Yeah.
He goes, take away, the song was called Toxic Breath.
Yeah.
It was about my ex, who's an alcoholic. Pot calling kettle there, mate.
Yeah.
he says drinking his red wine at 2 p.m. And he was just like, I was playing all these new hip-hop demos and, you know, some little offcuts from the album. And he was like, I really like Toxic. I was like, what, you want me to do like a sort of joke cover song? He went, no, the tempo.
Mm.
I was like, what do you mean? He goes, well, look, everything you're doing is like 90 BPM, 100 BPM. Why? And obviously they're Ministry of Sound.
Yeah, completely.
You know, most famous dance label in the world, dance brand. And he played me this beat. And I remember just like my manager was in the room. So my manager's like old school, like, you know, to be around in the rave days with Paul Oakenfold.
Used to
put out loads of techno and trance records, you know, bootlegs, all like. Every single album was by a different artist, made up name, you know.
So the tax man
couldn't trace him, and no one knew where the white label vinyl came from.
Yeah.
So his first love was dance music, my manager.
Yeah.
So he was like, amazing, this is exciting, you know. So they played me this beat, and he was like, Dave Dollymore, Ministry, who was the head of A&R then, said, just take it away and see what you come up with. So he played me this beat, and then I was taking it home, and I was like, just doing something like typical like me back then, just cheeky. And I came up with this phrase, show me your dirty face. And we put it out and we started playing it in the sets because I was still doing a couple of gigs here and there. Because I still, even though I was working in TV, I still was like, no, I'm going to go on tour.
Yeah.
And I was getting a grand a gig maybe, but I was spending 300 quid on the splitter and then 200 quid at Travel Lodges.
And then
my driver was the sound man, and I played my bass player 50 quid and then a DJ 50 quid a gig. So I was actually just breaking even. And this song, Show Me Your Dirty Face, became like the final song of the set. And then we started almost like on the decks, speeding up all of the older songs a bit more.
Right.
And then I started noticing And then I did a song called Hooligans.
Yeah.
With Don Diablo, who's a now massive, like globally as a DJ, but back then was only a star in Holland.
Yeah.
But, so this song called Hooligans, Zane Lowe made it hottest record in the world. And it was like my take on, I suppose, Prodigy.
Yeah.
But with just lyrics that were just only could come from my head.
But that's it. It was making that transition to Prodigy type thing of not being these packed out verses and then a hook. Yeah. It was having these, just a phrase, having a turn of phrase, this moment.
And having a punchline before the drop.
Yeah.
And I was like, because in my mind, I was like, I've always loved Prodigy. I've always loved Basement Jacks and Groove Armada. I was massively into UK Garage, Garage, when I was like 18, because I went to school in South London. So it was all jungle and garage. Yeah, and we used to go down to the Litton Tree, which is sadly closed down around the corner, and like fake ID when you're 17, get in. There'd be like, someone would get stabbed. You know, you might get, if you're lucky, you might get to lip some girl, and there'd be a guy on the mic. And it was all the classic old garage, you know.
It's a South London night out.
You know, I had Patrick Cox wannabes. I had red Moschino jeans.
I had
like a Ben Sherman shirt or whatever, you know what I mean? Yeah. Some Versace, whatever. And, spent a week's wages on one pair of jeans. And so I'd always liked that tempo and I could always spit over that.
Yeah.
Because at school, from the age of 11 to 18, hip-hop and Wu-Tang Clan became, after a while, almost uncool.
And then
garage and jungle came in and then garage music.
Yeah.
So I actually learnt to spit double time over everything anyway.
Yeah.
So when Ministry of Sound came calling, it was like the first time I could actually, because on the beats, on the streets days, I could only ever imagine supporting Mike Skinner. I thought that was the pinnacle of my career.
Yeah.
Now on dance music, and there's producers from Holland and America and Germany that they're getting me beats from. Because I'd only ever worked with one producer, a bit like you and Dan.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Example, and Russia. So Joe Gardner, Russia, who made my first album and mixtapes. He now is produces Mr. Jam Show at Radio 1, so he's still in music. But it was like, I'd been loyal to him, never experimented with other... And all of a sudden, all these beats coming through. And then I meet Chase and Status before their first album came out, when they were just sort of like big in the drum and bass scene. And then I met MJ Cole, and then Sub Focus, who produced Kickstarts for me.
Yeah.
And then they sort of put me in this sort of month-long writing camp with Ministry did with Metrophonic. So Metrophonic are like what they call a hit factory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like Dr. Luke and Max Martin in Sweden and all that. And,
yeah, yeah.
So I went to, they're based out in Guildford. And this period was really interesting because I went down there and it was almost like a masterclass in how to write pop songs.
Yeah.
So these guys had done Believe in Life After Love for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it was like number one in 28 countries.
Yeah.
So I was like, I just need to go down and learn. And even though, in a way, I was like listening to production and you played the production next to Chase and Status and Sub Focus, it didn't stand up to it in terms of what I wanted.
Yeah.
But it was undoubtedly amazing pop music.
Yeah.
And then I'm sat in a room with the guy who wrote Hero for Enrique Iglesias.
Yeah.
I can be a hero. And I was just like, this guy's pretty much got like 9 cars and 7 houses off of one song. And I'd never been interested in money. But I was just almost like, it was a combination of the freedom of being out of the hip-hop world, where I was never really accepted, or felt like I wasn't, because I was a white kid from West London, and I had long hair. And in my mind, I was like, my mum, even though we weren't posh and rich, in my mind, I was like, because we lived in a house and my mum and dad were married, I didn't have the right to rap, because you had to come from a council estate, regardless of your skin colour. Because now it's not a thing. You know, you can be whoever you are, whatever you want from whatever.
Yeah.
But back then, there was still a thing. What's your story? What's your street cred? All this
shit.
Yeah,
100%.
So my thing was like, well, I'll go to school with a load of ghetto people, but at the end of the day, I'm a white kid and I had long hair and my mum and dad are still married. So you can't have a career as a rapper.
Yeah.
And then as soon as my mindset was out of, I'm the next Mike Skinner, or that's what I want to be, or that's what he thinks I should be.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. Well, you love dance music. You love... you know, raving, you like rapping over that tempo. You're now working with these hit factory people. You're learning all their tricks.
Yeah.
How to move notes and melodies and what suits my voice and how you can just tweak that note there and it's, you know, 10 times more uplifting.
Yeah, 100%. And
so you're learning all these tricks straight. So I wrote Watch the Sun Come Up with them.
Yeah.
Which was my first top 40. It was like 17 or 18 in the chart. So put out Hooligans, Zane Lowe played that. Watch the Sun Come Up, Pete Tong championed it. Charted, And then it was like the next single came from that Hit Factory as well, Won't Go Quietly. That was like number six in the charts. And then everything I'd learnt from them, I was then applying to all the stuff I was writing with all, you know, the cool producers, guys. So I'm in the studio with Sub Focus, and he plays me just this bass line. It sounded almost like The Killers or U2. And it was just like, ding, 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 classic, like, festival riff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then towards the end of the song, I just heard this, that almost he had it in the background. I was like, why is that not like at the start of the song? Why is that not in the drop?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was my first input into production.
Yeah.
And like, what's hooky? And because up until then, I just accepted beats and then written raps over them.
Completely.
And a lot of time,
that's your role as the rapper to just jump on it.
So I was almost like fast tracked myself through contacts, meeting producers and, you know, Ministries, A&R, which was very cleverly of David Donovan, was just like, I'm going to let Elliot be Elliot, but I'm just going to sort of nudge him and gently guide him to certain people and certain, why don't you try this? And then the last record for my second album, Won't Go Quietly, was Kickstarts.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd actually sung and rapped the whole way through the track. There was no samples, there was no features. And I only laid down the singing as a guide vocal because I imagined someone else to sing it.
And they were like, but
that sounds great. And I was like, no, I don't. So I wasn't comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Because I used to have a really good singing voice when I was like 12, when I was in, you know, local theatre productions.
And
then I hit 16, voice broke.
Yeah.
And then I was scared to sing in public.
Yeah.
And because my voice is so deep, you just think, oh, it's not popping off. Anyway, Kickstarts was the blueprint because it charted at number 3.
Yeah.
It probably would have been number 1, but the World Cup was on. I think Dizzy Rascal's World Cup. You always remember the songs that beat you.
Dizzy Rascal's World Cup
song was number 1. And number 2 was K-9 Waving Flag. Right. We are the waving flag. And I was number 3 with Kickstarts, but we stuck around for ages. And then it was mad because it went from like earning $1,000 a gig to 10, 20 grand a gig in a space of month. So as I said before, it wasn't about the money, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's about the money. So because you've then got that sort of financial stability.
And I didn't even
look into the bank accounts. It wasn't that exciting. It was just sort of at the back of your mind.
How was that for you to go from kind of not knowing what you're chasing to suddenly having this huge success? And
I remember the main thing I just thought to myself,
and having that much input into it and that control, you know,
well, I sort of had to pinch myself and then be like, whatever you're doing right now, you know, really busy with gigs, recording whenever I could, because I was already working on what was then became my third album, Playing in the Shadows, when Kickstarts came out. I had a formula then as well. I was like, it's just banging beats, there's a drop, there's a catchphrase before it, and I probably will mainly focus on singing because I started realising in foreign language countries it was really starting to pick up.
Yeah.
I was getting bookings overseas. And then, you know, just have fun with it and just talk about what you're going through, which was like addiction and breakups and long nights and too much partying. And that just became my calling card. And then I just sort of applied that again.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, I'm not going to buy a house, not going to buy any cars. I've never been into jewellery. I'm not going to buy watches and all that shit. I'm still going to keep getting my freebies from Levi's and Puma.
Because I'm
like, this is who I am. This is what I am. And then for 2 years, I kind of held on to that.
Yeah.
I was still living with my step-granddad in a really sort of rundown house. Although it's in Fulham. You know, it's like £1 million house, but it's like a... I'm living there. I was almost like too scared to bring girls back because it wasn't the place to show off.
Yeah.
Still blagging freebies.
And
that, by staying in that mindset, I was able to then go, right, change the way you kiss me.
Yeah.
And then stay awake, which was number 1 as well. And all in this period, so I was just like, I probably did, in 2011, so it was the year after Kickstarts came out, I did 126 gigs.
Yeah.
And I look back on my diary now, recently I had to go back through my diary for some immigration forms I'm filling out for Australia. And it was like 1 week, or it was a few weeks where it was like, it might have been 5 or 6 gigs, say, over like 14 days.
Yeah.
But then in there as well would be like, Radio 1 Live Lounge, studio with Calvin, photo shoot for front cover of FHM, BBC Breakfast News, performance at Graham Norton, live band rehearsal.
Yeah.
And it was like burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I just split up with my girlfriend who I'd written all the songs about. So a lot of the inspiration came from that. And then I finally said, I've got to buy a property.
Yeah.
And then it was just this sort of like, you know, this train that just didn't stop.
Yeah.
And then I'd go to Australia to see my parents once a year for a month, and that was my chill out time.
Yeah.
I don't know how I didn't die during that period.
I was going to say, how was that being in the middle of all of that? Because you do have an addictive personality. You do have a bold, outgoing character. So was there a risk of it all going to your head, or you doing yourself in?
I don't think
it ever
went to my head, because I had good people around me.
Yeah.
And all my best mates would always give me shit. And they'd always, whenever I was out of line. And so, that was important, because I didn't just have, hangers on and people who wanted to just like sponge off me.
Because it's a weird one, because
I've got the same circle of friends now
that
I've had for like 12 years in this industry. So the best men at my wedding were my DJ, Sam, and Andy, who you just met, who's like my bass player, my engineer. And they're the first people to pick me up and everything.
And that's key, because it's a mad thing, because circumstance can change interpretation.
Yeah.
A lot. So if
it
you're
like the start of one of your songs,
yeah, it does exactly. So if you're at a festival, early days with Mike and with Steve, and you're being loud and leery, like, oh, they're keen, they're excited. If you're headlining that festival and you're being loud and leery, they'll be like, who's this prick? Do you know what I mean? So there's that balance of you can remain exactly the same, but depending on where you are status wise, it can look as if you're being, full of yourself or over the top or whatever. Yeah. So it's that mad mix, right?
Yeah, because sometimes like just confidence.
Yeah.
And my sense of humour, which is a lot of it, it's just like sarcasm, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
Of course.
And just puns and just think it's like dad's humour, really. I was doing dad jokes before I became a dad. But if people haven't met you in person, I just catch a little glimpse of you on TV or whatever, they start to think you're like a really arrogant, cocky prick.
Yeah.
So I've had to do a lot of PR recently, over the years afterwards, because you become so aware of everything you're saying and doing, and how you just throw away comment about something, and then you look on Twitter the next day.
Yeah.
And I was very, I'm not an Instagram generation person. I'm more of a Twitter generation.
Yeah,
I went from 80,000 followers to 2.5 million in a year.
Yeah.
Right. And I was getting probably 2,000 tweets a day, and I was reading a load of them, because it becomes addictive. And then there'll be abuse, and you just be like, how do people not know me for who I am? How do they not get that humour? And then you start overthinking it. But the whole thing is like, a lot of people, when they sign to major labels, like in boy bands and, the next, big female solo singer, they go through media training.
Yeah.
And I'd never had that. And I was learning media training.
Yeah.
I was making mistakes.
Yeah.
Whilst I was having number ones.
One of the things I'd notice, I'd see you on TV every now and then, and if I saw you, it's the same with anyone who It's like, oh, they're going to be on something. If I'm about, I'll give it a look.
So, Elliot's on Buzzcocks. Yeah, I'll go and watch that. Yeah.
Exactly. And I definitely felt that around the time you settled down with your missus and you had a kid and things like that, the Elliot I was seeing on TV was changing hugely. Mm. Now, that probably just coincides with you just becoming more aware of how it all works. Because, again, I'd watch and laugh, but I'd also be like, some people are going to take that wrong, or some people are going to read that as this or read that as that.
Sometimes, because I'm still that awkward kid in the playground.
Yeah.
Like, feeling a bit like you don't
say something.
Fit.
Yeah.
You should say something, I have to stop myself.
Yeah.
And I recently said something on, The Last Leg.
Yeah.
I was on there and I was doing so well and I was chatting and then just like verbal diarrhea, made some stupid, like nothing to do with anything comment about Scousers. And you could just see the TV presenter, and it went out live as well. So they couldn't edit, and you could just see him sort of going, And I was just like, what the fuck? So then I was dreading looking on Twitter.
Yeah.
This was only in January.
Yeah.
Some Scousers are going to be like fucking angry, and I'm playing Liverpool Music, International Music Festival this summer, and I'm going to have to cancel. And there was like four or five people going, what's your fucking problem?
And
I'm like, no, I love Liverpool. Well, what do you mean? But that's just me. It's just like...
Speaking in that moment.
I've always put my foot in it. I always say stuff at inopportune moments and,
So how was it to have that huge climb, to be having number ones, to be having huge festival gigs, huge shows, to go from a few thousand to a few million on Twitter, things like that. But then have the pressure of that's what you now need to recreate or that's what you need to redo. Because, I mean, we'll get to it as we've been going over an hour now, but we'll get to it. Is one of the things that made this perfect timing is you've left Sony and started your own label. How was that? What was the kind of transition there?
So I did three albums with Ministry.
Yeah.
So my fourth album, Evolution of Man, came out in 2012. And that was like, I always wanted to do a rock grunge album because I love grunge music. And it was like an electronically produced rock album. Yeah. I had Graham Coxon play guitar on five of the tunes.
Yeah.
Just so that Enemy would like it.
Yeah.
And it's still my favourite album personally. Ministry, God bless them, they let me do it. I should have gone and made another Five Chains Where You Kiss Me's and had another load of number ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to the point where I was like, I only wanted to make music that I loved because that's what I'd always done.
Yeah.
And then you realise, I need to play the game. And the reason I didn't do another album of Ministry is they probably thought, what the fuck's he going to do next? Like some psy, trance, country album, folk album. and when they couldn't believe I stumbled on songs like Kickstarts and Chains Where You Kiss Me, because it's like, oh, you have one hit. It's very rare that you repeat it.
Yeah.
And I had, either as a feature or as an example, I had like 17 top 40s in 3 years.
That's mad.
And I was never trying to write hits.
Yeah.
You know, and then after leaving Ministry, I signed to Sony because I stupidly thought, and don't get wrong, majors work for some people, but I was like, well, I'm already this big. You know, I'm already selling out arenas.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to sell out arenas in America and Europe because, you know, you sign to someone like Sony, because Island Records came in for me as well.
Yeah.
And then Sony came in for me, or Epic Records at Sony. I was like, well, it's easy. I'll just write a load more hits, which is it comes easy to me.
Yeah.
And now when it becomes the number one in the UK, they can then feed that to their, you know, their Sony offices in Germany and Benelux and Asia and South America. And I'm going to be traveling. I mean, I was signed to Ministry, but I was only signed in the UK. So they then had to sell on my tracks to certain regions.
Because this was before
Spotify. So it wasn't like you put a song up and it was available everywhere at the same time. So my thing was like, well, I've already played festivals. I've done festivals in 47 countries.
Yeah.
Like in the space of like 2 years.
Yeah.
So I was like, now not only can I play these places, I can go and tour them. And, you know, headline their festivals. Because that's how you think. Not in an egotistical way, but you're like, I've made this up as I've gone along. And I've been pretty good at it.
It's been working. And particularly when you're in the system, it becomes goal-based. It doesn't become, what do I want? It goes, right, well, I've had this. The next things are this. Here's where I need to reach.
On my fourth album, The Evolution of Man, I had one song called Say Nothing. Yeah. And I had another song called with Calvin, We'll Be Coming Back. And those songs were both number two in the charts. Mm. And I remember being really, really upset.
Mad, isn't it?
You'd rather you were three or four.
It's nuts, yeah.
And that's sort of like where my head was at the time.
Yeah.
Because you just think, and I've met my wife. I was touring Australia, which I'd always wanted to tour because obviously my family were there.
Yeah,
in my mind, I was like, I need to end up in Australia one day.
Yeah, that's the
because
end.
One of the reasons me and my ex split up, apart from for that period, I was a horrible cheating bastard. I was like, eventually I need to settle down in Australia. And she was like, no way I'm moving to Australia. So at the back of your mind, you're like, well, we're going to have to split up at some point then.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be based there one day.
It's got a time limit.
And then I'm in Australia and this woman walks into the room and I'm like, oh my God. And I was like, who's that? And they're like, oh, that's Erin McNoyce. Yeah. What's she? Oh, she won Miss Australia, Miss Universe. And she was in Neighbours and now this is her show. Fucking hell, it's the best interview I've ever done. I haven't even done the interview.
Yeah.
But then I was also thinking, I've got zero chance of there because she's famous in Australia. She's earning her own money. She don't need me. Up until that point, I was like, I'm still the geeky, you know, kid I am nerd that I was in school. Like, I'm aware of my massive teeth and like my nose and my ears sticking out. So I'm like, all right, I'm pulling some really fit birds at the moment, but I'm example.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. You know, I should be.
There's the reason. Yeah.
And I'm like, then I met her and I'm like, she doesn't need me. She's, you know. What's she need me for? She's got her own money. It's stupid that you think like that, but that's how I thought. And then I got back from the interview and she messaged me on Twitter. She was like, that's the most fun interview I've ever done. I'm coming to see you at the festival at the weekend. Anyway, it was like love at first sight.
Amazing.
Hit off. But then I was trying to write for this fifth album with Sony or Epic Records. They were like, we need you to just do more We'll Be Coming Back. And we need to do more Chains Where You Kiss Me. It's just like, They didn't have any direction. They didn't put me with anyone in particular.
Yeah.
They were like, you know where to get beats from. That sort of thing.
Right, yeah.
And then it was like, fuck.
Yeah.
And then because I wasn't having fun with it and I wasn't sort of relaxed about it. Also, I was probably too happy. I should have taken a year off of writing music because I just got married to like Miss Australia. You know what I mean? In Byron Bay.
Yeah.
And like, I'd bought my second property and life was good and I should have just chilled. But I love writing too much. I love being in the studio. I love a challenge. But I was going to the studio and all I could think about was at the back of my mind, the worst A&R and advice ever, which is repeat what you've done, repeat what you've done.
Yeah.
Rather than, I don't know, mate, surprise me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
so and when you listen to my fifth album, Live Life Living, it's so weird because half the album's produced by Stuart Price.
Right.
Who, you know, if people don't know, one of the most legendary UK producers of probably the last 10, 20 years. Yeah. Like The Killers, Madonna,
yeah.
Pet Shop Boys. So I went over to live with him in LA, made this amazing sort of acid tinged sort of dance, pop, rock. And then the other half of the album I did with Fraser T. Smith,
right.
Who's produced for like Adele and Rita Ora. He did Stormzy's album. Yeah. He did Kano's album. Amazing producer. But I came back from like this sort of month writing and they were desperate to have a song out because like ride the crest of this wave that Example had left Ministry, gone to Sony. We need a hit.
Yeah.
We need Strike While the Iron's Hot. And I listened to these songs and I was like, we had like 20 demos and 10 of them sounded like one artist and 10 of them sounded like the other.
Yeah.
And there wasn't one standout hit. As an album, we could have, say, taken all the Stuart Price songs and it would have been an amazing album.
Yeah, maybe that
was the right thing to do. But they were sort of like trying to, you know, put a square peg into a round hole.
Yeah.
And they ended up, there's a song that I wrote for a boy band. Because so around this time as well, I wrote Chasing the Sun for The Wanted.
Yeah.
So I went into the studio with the Hit Factory guys, Metrophonic.
Yeah.
Wrote, and they were like, right, we need to write a song for Kylie Minogue. So wrote the song Chasing the Sun for Kylie Minogue. I demoed it. And then we pitched the vocals so it sounded a bit Kylie, because Kylie's got quite a deep vocal for a female anyway. And then I got an email from her, oh, I really appreciate you writing this song for me, it's great, but it's not right for my sound. We want to get away from dance music. And then we got a call from the head of Capital, Global Radio.
Yeah.
And they also managed The Wanted. Like,
right.
Talk about fucking monopolies, mate.
Not only
are we going to manage band, we're just going to playlist you on Capital Day. Yeah. So they just had a massive hit. And they were like, we want to record this song you've written for Kylie. And that was number two in the charts over here, but it was number one in America.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Like, that's, you know, one of those songs where it's just like, it buys you a house in Australia, that vibe.
Completely, yeah.
And then I had some other pop songs lying around, which I'd written for boy bands, you know, generic boy band A.
Yeah.
Great name, actually.
Yeah.
And it was called Kids Again. And the lyrics are like, kids again, let's behave like kids again. And had the video been like kids with strippers, kids doing drugs, kids doing adult stuff. Remember the Biggie and Puff Daddy one where it was like them dressed as the
kid versions.
I thought we could maybe do something with this, but I was like, this is a boy band song.
Yeah.
And they were like, look, it sounds very Calvin Harris-y. It was actually hearing phrases like that.
Yeah.
And then you're like, fuck, I've just signed to these cunts. And like, I'm in for three albums and the first album hasn't even come out. And we put out one song and it charted at 13 and then they were like, Kids Again's the one. I was like, oh, fuck. And then having to be excited about doing it, I'm like, maybe they're right. Maybe this is going to be a hit. And then after that, I can do what I want. Charted at 13 as well. So it charted at the same spot as the weird sort of acid rave track that we've had before. Yeah. Then they're like, oh, fuck, what do we do? Then I'd been in the studio writing a song for Cheryl Cole.
Right.
And then we took it back and made it my single, One More Day, Stay With Me.
Yeah.
So that was like, that saved that album. That charted at like number four.
Yeah.
And then this was like where the obsession between like chart positions and this
it's
became
mad, isn't
from.
It?
Because before I didn't care. It was just like, amazing, we're number one.
I want to make some good music. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was just like chasing the chart position and the Capital FM playlist. And that's not me. Because when I'd get a call and be like, oh, you're on the Capital A-list. I'd be like, fucking sick, is this good?
Yeah.
You know?
Thanks for telling me.
And then Epic Records disbanded. They had three MDs running this company. We all hated each other. We're all on different vibes. All earning stupid money.
Yeah.
Imagine like what an executive record label earns, but having three of them.
Yeah.
And the only people on the label were me and Foxes.
Yeah.
So I would have had to sell like 7 million albums just to break even and pay their fucking wages.
Yeah, that's
so it was never going to work. So then I was stuck within the Sony system without actually being assigned to a specific imprint.
Home. Yeah.
And then I got picked up by Columbia. And then that was like a year ago. And then I'm playing them songs. And then they, you know, we tried a single in January. That didn't work or work like they wanted to. I wanted to just keep releasing music. So I'm like, I don't know which one's going to be a hit. We don't have to shoot videos because they're always like, as soon as you say we're going to put out a single, you've got to pay the producer, and because you're on a major, the producer usually gets $3,000 a beat, wants $10,000 a beat, because you're on a fucking major label.
Then
you need 4 or 5 remixes, or we need all the specialists ticked off at, you know, Kiss FM and
session of the remixes, which I honestly think if you've got one that really bangs, then that's great. But it's this obsession over.
But you should go to the main song. You know what I mean? If the main song's good enough, then
you go off that. Yeah, completely. There is always an obsession if we need 4 or 5 different remixes. We need an iTunes exclusive. We need this and that. And it's all just.
Can you do an acoustic version? And all. Who, it's like, yeah, well, I can, but.
Yeah, no one is that into all that shit. The hit is the hit. If they like the song, then they like the song. It's very rare that a remix is the big. The big thing that turns it.
So. And then on top of that, you've got, like, say, the artwork.
It's old industry outlook. Yeah. It's the way it used to be. It's getting those extra 12s and
so
things
by,
like that.
So by that point, just from remixes and delivering the song, mixed and mastered, they've spent $15,000.
Yeah.
Right? So, and because I'm a numbers man, as I said to you before, I've always loved maths, and my dad wanted to go and work in a bank or be an accountant. So I'm there, and I'm always adding this up in my head. So I'm like, okay, I've left Epic. They've wiped the debt there, so I'm starting fresh with Columbia. But already, they spent $15,000, and the song hasn't even come out, and we haven't shot a video yet.
Yeah,
we've got to basically have 3 million streams just before we break even.
Yeah,
and that there's a fine balance now. Whether you've got a song on 500,000, and then once you hit that sort of magic mark, 4 or 5 million, all of a sudden you can be at 50 million streams.
Yeah,
and then you're making real money in today's terms. And
it's madness, though, that it's on streams now. It's not a record sales thing. It's fucking like, mental. It's streams you need to
So
hit.
Then we get video pitches in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I've got this wicked idea for a video. I can shoot it for about $4,000. And like, no, we really want you to work with this director. You know, it's a big statement. It's a big example. Come back. And I was like, oh, fuck's it. All right. And then you get the video pitches in. How much is it going to be? Because you're on a major, $30,000. Of course they are, because the directors earn 10% of the budget.
Yeah,
why is the director going to do 2-3 days work if he's not getting paid $2,000-$3,000? So therefore the budget has to be $20,000. There's no favours.
Yeah, yeah.
So then the single still hasn't come out. And then we've got a $30,000 video, $15,000 on remixes. And so then they want to do a photo shoot for the artwork. And I'm like, okay, I've got my mate who I've done some photos with, Sean. But no, we've got this new guy. He used to work with Rankin. He's really good. And like the fellow was really sick. But then it's like, you could go and do some photos for $500. But it's costing $4,000 because then you've got a stylist who's like $500 a day.
Yeah,
and it's
and
the only reason I became so aware of these costs, because I was never on ministry. Obviously, I knew what stuff cost, but it wasn't in my mind.
Yeah.
A, we were having success, and B, I was having fun making music.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, whatever, just ride the wave. And all of a sudden, I'm panicking because I'm starting to doubt myself because I haven't had a hit since 2014.
Yeah, I'm
still getting bookings. I'm still doing like 50, 60 gigs a year. So I'm fine. Financially, but I don't want to have a hit, but I just want to have some songs where people are like, fucking that new example tune is sick.
And I don't know what that
song is.
Yeah.
And I still don't. But I'm like, this ain't going to go well. So I was like, whether I believe in this song or not, whether Radio 1 playlist it or not, I know that we've spent like $50,000 and the song ain't even come out.
Yeah.
So we need to be on like 10 million streams if they're going to even do another single with me.
Yeah.
And then after the first few weeks, you can just see that it's not going to do that. Anyway. Parted ways with Columbia.
Yeah.
And here we are.
And that's...
Because you've always got to have something to plug.
Well, that's what's exciting is the stuff... You've got a mixtape. So this will be coming out in August. And you're going to be doing 4 videos in 4 weeks, all coming out. So a couple of them will be out when this comes out. And I had to listen to that on the SoundCloud link you sent me. And again, it's that combination. More so the stuff... that you played me here as well, though.
Yeah.
The combination of the early example of telling stories, who's comfortable as a rapper, and the example who's comfortable as a singer. And I feel, till now, those two hadn't crossed over. It felt that when you were singing, if you had to rap, you wanted to leave rap behind you. And like, as you were saying, you were the white kid whose parents hadn't split up. So you felt you had to get away from it. So when you were comfortable with rap, you were killing it.
Yeah,
and when you were... finally getting comfortable with singing, you weren't into the rap part of it. So it was always that starting point where you were like, I'm not really a singer, but I'm not a rapper anymore. It was that kind of that transition.
There's such different art forms in a way.
Yeah.
But as Drake's proven, it's fine to do both and just pick and choose when you want to do either. But I started to think that, you know, especially when you start traveling the world and performing, and you're like, are they reacting to the music here? Do they like to sing? Do I even need to rap? So my whole fifth album, the Live Life Living, the one that came out on Epic, which was the least epic experience of my life, that was no rapping on that album.
Mm.
And then I thought, oh, this is going to be this is going to make me even bigger because, like, you know, I'm going to be big in America now.
Yeah.
Because Americans don't care about UK rappers. Yeah, yeah, shit. Like, yeah, you start thinking stupid
yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
And then the main response on the iTunes reviews and then social media is just like, why aren't you rapping? Why aren't you rapping?
Yeah.
So then you're like, should I just do rap again and just find the fine balance? But this mixtape, Bangers and Ballads, the main reason, so A, we set up our own label. We're going through Cobalt Distribution. You know, it's great. It's like, you get, you know, on a major label, you're getting like 25% return. Yeah. After you've recouped all those stupid costs we were just talking about.
Yeah, which all
and now I'm going for somewhere where I'm getting the flip of that. Again, like 75. So, yeah. And again, it's not about that cash, but it's nice to have in the back of your mind that, you know, you've got a better deal than all your mates on the majors.
It also makes you more committed and dedicated to the project and to the role. If you're, as said, if you've got to that point on Columbia where you're going, oh man, before it's even come out, we're this much in the hole. It means that you're not going to be 100% excited about it yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
So how can you expect your audience to be?
So all this Bangers and Ballads,
they're going to feel that. Whereas the vibe I got off you with Bangers and Ballads when you hit me up about it was, you got to hear this.
Yeah.
I'm buzzing about this. I need you to know about this.
Because I could have come to you in January and said, let me jump on your podcast. And it's like, well, no, I obviously wasn't excited then.
Yeah.
Because I'm excited to chat about my stuff again. And five of the nine tracks on this were songs that Columbia said no to. You know, we all of them, like Into Darkness, which is about going away on tour and finding, you know, off into the night almost and then coming back to the family. I played that to Epic like 18 months ago and they were like, it's an amazing song and it sounds like a hit, but we don't think your fans want to hear about you talking about like being a dad. And like, well, the song's not about being a dad. There's like one lyric in there. It's like, I'll come home and my son's on the doorstep and we can rub noses. And it's quite cute. I was like, there's 17-year-old kids out there who've got kids.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
I was like, if people got younger brothers and sisters, they've got, you know, their brothers. I was like, why is it so anti-family, man?
It's ignorant because the fact is that you pick up on the lines that you connect with.
Yeah.
You don't really hear the lines you don't connect to. Exactly, it's not like you're going to go,
I was really feeling it
until that one line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's not how music works.
And then some people
days.
Meet you and they're like, and you tell them what it's about and they go, oh, fuck, I had no idea it was 100%, about that.
100%.
Because I reckon that most people just hear the whole song and sometimes don't even zone into the actual lyrics. They like the sound of your voice.
I completely agree. And even if they're into the lyrics, as I said, they'll be into chunks of it or there'll be a certain bit that really rings home with them and they'll be thinking about that all through the next verse.
But you
so
and I,
they're not 100% listening to that next verse.
You and I probably listen to lyrics more than the average person by virtue of what we do. But I bet you there's songs that you've been listening to for 10, 20 years and you still lyrics pop up and you go, 100%. Why have I never heard that?
Yeah, 100%.
So the first thing getting out of this system was like, I'm going to, all the songs that I'm sat on, sat on hundreds of songs, but all the songs that I'm sat on and love that Sony, various people at Sony were like, nope.
Yeah.
You know, it's too grown up. Capital won't play it. You know, stuff like that. Like, this song's, I had one song last year and the feedback was like, this is amazing, but I don't know what Spotify playlist it would sit on. Imagine being told your song's amazing. You're like, I know it's fucking amazing because I wouldn't have brought it and played to you because I can't believe I stumbled upon a song this good because the last 2 years I was writing utter shit.
Right.
And I was depressed and fucking, you know what I mean? Even though I was having birth of my kid, I was depressed musically, creatively.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and they're like, yeah, it's amazing. And you're like, yeah, cool, we're going to get a single out. And they're like, but I don't know what Spotify plays. So who fucking cares?
Yeah.
Spotify, like, their algorithm's changing constantly. They don't know what the next sound is. They just,
it's,
like...
It's the obsession,
make your song, which is undefinable, because it's like, because I sit between rap and dance and pop, and then my voice isn't like your high-pitched, sweet soul voice.
Yeah.
I'm my own genre anyway. So whatever song I've got, I don't expect it to fit on every playlist.
And again, the things that break through a breakthrough and... we were discussing before we got going, for me, a Thou Shout and Interdiction are the two that had the most airplay, had the most video watches and everything.
What was that video I was in for you? Letter from God to Man.
Letter from God to Man,
I still get the occasional tweet, like once, twice a year. Yeah. Oh my God, just for
that
example,
was a mad
in Scooby's
one. Again,
Scooby's
in that
Pips
time,
video.
We had you in there, we had Docker's MC was in that one as well.
It's
not the stuff that you can necessarily predict, and I know that sounds like I'm harking back to old times, but Stormzy's an example of that.
Just a new video every two, three months, and some of them are no choruses, just him rapping,
and that's just like homemade videos because that's what people care about. It's not labels seem to have this obsession previously with Capital or Radio 1. then it becomes a session with a Spotify playlist. Yeah. And that all makes sense because it's all quantifiable. And you can say, if you're on this, you will be heard by this amount of people. So I understand it because it's damage limitation. You can't predict what will just grab the people rather than the playlist or the bookers or whoever's in charge of the A-list Capital at that point. What will just grab the people and get them excited? And that's what makes a difference. Because
And I've got to be excited about it. Because if I'm excited about it,
100%.
Then I know that there's other people are excited about it.
Yeah.
And it's the best thing knowing where I'm at now is whatever happens,
yeah,
I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's perfect.
I'm in the middle of like summer season, festival season. I've already done 9 gigs this summer. I've got like 18 more to go.
Yeah.
And I'm still getting booked, whether it's off my back catalogue or people like my gigs. I don't really care. And now I'm about to drop new music on them.
Yeah.
And if this fails, you know what I mean? I'm shooting two videos this weekend. They're costing like $3,000 each.
Yeah, yeah.
My mate's shooting them on an old mini DV camera.
Amazing.
I'm throwing a boat party on Saturday. I've got 20 fans coming down who've recently got married. They're all dressing up in wedding dresses and suits.
I love it.
For a song called Show Me How to Love. And it's just like, I'm doing exactly what I did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Obviously, there's not pressing vinyls anymore and CDs. It's just straight on Spotify and you know, Apple Music or whatever.
But what's exciting as well.
The videos and the artwork. Like the artwork, I did a photo shoot and then just got my phone out. And then, because I was inspired by Kanye's approach, even though like, the last album was fucking weird. But his album cover, he shot the Rocky Mountains on his way to his listening party in Montana. And then just squiggled across it and that became the artwork.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, that's genius. It's like, if everything is just eaten up now from a picture someone takes off Twitter and Instagram, and then they put that in the paper the next day and it's low quality because it's come from social media, he's doing the exact opposite of what it should be, which is like, you need a glossy photo shoot and then you need an illustrator, designer to do your font and your text. And why can't I just have it in my phone and just use the Apple thing to squiggle the name of the album on it?
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. I love that. And it's that approach that will come across and connect with the fan base. Is they can tell that when you're excited about it, because you are like, again, once or twice I've had people say, oh, you're plugging or whatever this is a bit much at the moment. Or Taboo is a prime example. When I did that, I was like, I'm plugging it a lot because I'm fucking excited, because I'm involved in something that I would have killed to be involved
with. You're like, fucking hell, I'm on TV with Tom Hardy. You're like, this is so my personality and my interest. And like, it's so quirky and mad. And like,
and that's it. It allows you to do that promotion side of it, which is key on social media and things like that. But if you've got that right excitement and energy yourself, you're not sitting there thinking, oh, have I done too many posts today? I should save that.
I can't wait to post about...
This is great. Look at this.
I can't wait to post about this mixtape. Yeah. I'm going to be dropping clips of it all day on my social media because I fucking love it.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, what it's all about, man.
So I'll round things up now. Where can people keep up to date with everything? So I said, this will be coming out a couple of weeks into August. So it'll be you've started to put out the 4 videos.
Yeah. So we're doing August the 3rd's first single. And
that's my birthday. Oh, nice. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. And then a week later, another song. And then the full mixtape.
Yeah.
And then I've already got sort of like singles, which I've played you earlier as well, like lined up for later in the year, start next year.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make it up as I go along and just be reactive.
And hearing those... I love the singles that are all coming out in August because it feels... It feels like example. It feels like the example that was these big hits and all that kind of thing. But what I liked about the stuff that's coming out next year as well is it feels like a mix between the two. It's not going back to old example. And it shouldn't, because you're not him anymore.
Exactly.
So it shouldn't, but it's got the best bits of that and the best bits of everything in between. And that's what's... I love the fact that there's these certain things that as much as you want to and as much as labels will want you to, you can't fast track it. You need to exist and go through these journeys to go, here's what I am, here's my sound.
I mean, the first track on the album is actually called Sit Down Gary.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with Gary or sitting down. You've heard it with that sort of Bengali sample.
I
thought when the guy produced it with me played it, that sample, I thought it was going, sit down Gary. But
that's exactly what I assumed.
I sent the demo
because I saw the name and I'm like, I'm not hearing it. And I was like, oh, is that the sample in the background?
Yeah, it's nothing to do with Gary. But the best thing about starting the mixtape with that is it's the last track that we made. So the day before we delivered the mixtape, we recorded that the night before.
Oh, wow.
Like finished it at 3 a.m. And then I rushed over to DJ Zinc to get it mixed for me the next day. It made mastering. So it made the deadline. That is the approach to music. That's how it should be.
Yeah.
Not like you get it to the label, the major label, then they get it mixed and mastered, then they sit on it and then wait, and then 3 months later it comes out. We made this. So I thought the mixtape was done, and then we made it one night, finished it at 4 a.m. And then it, as the late addition to the album, and it's the lead single, it's the first track on the album. And then I said to, on the mixtape, and then my manager's like, the working title of the demo, Sit Down Gary. Because even though the chorus look is, do you mind I'm out my mind?
Yeah.
And he's just like, let's just call it Sit Down Gary. It's clickbait, isn't it? It's like, if you're on Spotify, even if you don't like Example, you don't know who Example is. If you see a song called Sit Down
what
Gary,
the fuck is Sit Down
you've
Gary?
Got to fucking click it. And then at the end of the song, you're like, you didn't even mention Gary.
Yeah.
And the opening lyric to that song is, I've made some bad decisions lately, but girl, I love the way you hate me.
Yeah.
And without sounding like a dick, it's probably the most Example lyric ever. You know what I mean? It's up there, you know, never been afraid of the highest heights and shit like that.
Yeah.
And these are just lyrics that you just I stumble upon because I haven't overthought them. I'm having fun with it.
Yeah.
And it's like a big fuck you. It's like a fuck you to the major system. And nothing personal against them. They didn't know what to do with me. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love I've made some bad decisions lately as the opening lyrics of the mixtape.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's probably a nice place to end as well.
I love it. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much your time. It's been a pleasure catching up. And I look forward to seeing the videos and all that is to come.
Nice one, mate.
Nice one, buddy.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Example. We got into it there. We talked for a long while. I hope you were okay with the stop for pizza, the break, all the weirdness. But yeah, it was great to catch up with Elliot. As said, I've known him a long time and it's exciting. Been exciting to watch his career develop and change and evolve, and it's wicked to see where he's at now and taking control of it himself and being the master of his own destiny. Thank you for tuning in. As I said, I'll be back next week with a guest that I'm not announcing yet. We'll see. It's a big one, but I want to just drop it out of nowhere to make your jaws drop. Obviously, you should be checking out the Films to Be Buried With podcast. It's blowing up. They've had over 100,000 downloads in the first month. It's on the Distraction Pieces Network. It's fantastic. Hardcore Listing is still killing it. Over 500,000 downloads. Off the Beaten Track is smashing it. As Hey Why to Drugs, Stop and Search. Choose Night Joy will be back soon. And Choose Night Joy is about to break the 500,000 downloads mark, so I'm excited for their return to push them over that line. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you all next week. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.